This is Audible.
Forward. Many of the people holding this book have followed the adventures of Roland and his band, his quartet, for years, some of them from the very beginning. Others, and I hope there are many, newcomers and constant readers alike, may ask, can I read and enjoy this story if I haven't read the other Dark Tower books? My answer is yes, if you keep a few things in mind. First, Midworld lies next to our world, and there are many overlaps. In some places there are doorways between the two worlds, and sometimes there are thin places, porous places, where the two worlds actually mingle. Three of Roland's quartet, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake, have been drawn separately from troubled lives in New York into Roland's Midworld quest. Their fourth traveling companion, a billy bumbler named Oi, is a golden-eyed creature native to Midworld. Midworld is very old and falling to ruin, filled with monsters and untrustworthy magic. Second, Roland Deschain of Gilead is a gunslinger, one of a small band that tries to keep order in an increasingly lawless world. If you think of the gunslingers of Gilead as a strange combination of knights-errant and territorial marshals in the Old West, you'll be close to the mark. Most of them, although not all, are descended from the line of the old White King, known as Arthur Eld. I told you there were overlaps. Third, Roland has lived his life under a terrible curse. He killed his mother, who was having an affair, mostly against her will and certainly against her better judgment, with a fellow you will meet in these pages. Although it was by mistake, he holds himself accountable, and the unhappy Gabrielle Deschain's death has haunted him since his young manhood. These events are fully narrated in the Dark Tower cycle, but for our purposes here, I think it's all you have to know. For long-time readers, this book should be shelved between Wizard in Glass and Wolves of the Kala, which makes it, I suppose, Dark Tower 4.5. As for me, I was delighted to discover my old friends had a little more to say. It was a great gift to find them again, years after I thought their stories were told.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Wind Through the Keyhole, a Dark Tower novel by Stephen King. Read by the author.
Stark Blast. During the days after they left the Green Palace that wasn't Oz after all, but which was now the tomb of the unpleasant fellow Roland's quartet had known as the Tick-Tock Man, the boy Jake began to range farther and farther ahead of Roland, Eddie, and Susanna. "Don't you worry about him?" Susanna asked Roland, "out there on his own?" "He's got Oi with him," Eddie said, referring to the billy bumbler who had adopted Jake as his special friend. "Mr. Oi gets along with nice folks all right, but he's got a mouthful of sharp teeth for those who aren't so nice, as that guy Gasher found out to his sorrow." "Jake also has his father's gun," Roland said, "and he knows how to use it. That he knows very well, and he won't leave the path of the beam." He pointed overhead with his reduced hand. The low-hanging sky was mostly still, but a single corridor of clouds moved steadily southeast, toward the land of Thunderclap, if the note left behind for them by the man who styled himself R.F. had told the truth. Toward the Dark Tower. "But why?" Susanna began, and then her wheelchair hit a bump. She turned to Eddie. "Watch where you're pushing me, sugar." "Sorry," Eddie said. "Public Works hasn't been doing any maintenance along this stretch of the turnpike lately. Must be dealing with budget cuts." It wasn't a turnpike, but it was a road, or had been, two ghostly ruts with an occasional tumble-down shack to mark the way. Earlier that morning, they had even passed an abandoned store with a barely readable sign, Took's Outland Mercantile. They investigated inside for supplies. Jake and Oi had still been with them then, and had found nothing but dust, ancient cobwebs, and the skeleton of what had been either a large raccoon, a small dog, or a billy bumbler. Oi had taken a cursory sniff and then pissed on the bones before leaving the store to sit on the hump in the middle of the old road with his squiggle of a tail curled around him. He faced back the way they had come, sniffing the air. Roland had seen the bumbler do this several times lately, and although he had said nothing, he pondered it. Someone trailing them, maybe? He didn't actually believe this, but the bumbler's posture, nose lifted, ears pricked, tail curled, called up some old memory or association that he couldn't quite catch. "Why does Jake want to be on his own?" Susanna asked. "Do you find it worrisome, Susanna of New York?" Roland asked. "Yes, Roland of Gilead, I find it worrisome." She smiled amiably enough, but in her eyes the old mean light sparkled. That was the Detta Walker part of her, Roland reckoned. It would never be completely gone, and he wasn't sorry. Without the strange woman she had once been still buried in her heart like a chip of ice, she would have been only a handsome black woman with no legs below the knees. With Detta on board, she was a person to be reckoned with. A dangerous one. A gunslinger. "He has plenty of stuff to think about," Eddie said quietly. "He's been through a lot. Not every kid comes back from the dead. And it's like Roland says, if someone tries to face him down, it's the someone who's apt to be sorry." Eddie stopped pushing the wheelchair, arms sweat from his brow, and looked at Roland. "Are there someones in this particular suburb of nowhere, Roland, or have they all moved on?" "Oh, there are a few, I wot." He did more than wot. They had been peeked at several times as they continued their course along the path of the beam. Once by a frightened woman with her arms around two children and a babe hanging in a sling from her neck. Once by an old farmer, a half-mutie with a jerking tentacle that hung from one corner of his mouth. Eddie and Susanna had seen none of these people, or sensed the others that Roland felt sure had, from the safety of the woods and high grasses, marked their progress. Eddie and Susanna had a lot to learn. But they had learned at least some of what they would need, it seemed, because Eddie now asked, "Are they the ones Oi keeps sending up behind us?" "I don't know." Roland thought of adding that he was sure something else was on Oi's strange little bumbler mind and decided not to. The gunslinger had spent long years with no quartet, and keeping his own counsel had become a habit, one he would have to break if the tet was to remain strong. But not now. Not this morning. "Let's move on," he said. "I'm sure we'll find Jake waiting for us up ahead." 2 hours later, just shy of noon, they breasted a rise and halted, looking down at a wide, slow-moving river, gray as pewter beneath the overcast sky. On the northwestern bank, their side, was a barn-like building painted a green so bright it seemed to yell into the muted day. Its mouth jutted out over the water on pilings painted a similar green. Docked to two of these pilings by thick hawsers was a large raft, easily 90 feet by 90, painted in alternating stripes of red and yellow. A tall wooden pole that looked like a mast jutted from the center, but there was no sign of a sail. Several wicker chairs sat in front of the pole, facing the shore on their side of the river. Jake was seated in one of these. Next to him was an old man in a vast straw hat, baggy green pants, and long boots. On his top half he wore a thin white garment, the kind of shirt Roland thought of as a slinkum. Jake and the old man appeared to be eating well-stuffed popkins. Roland's mouth sprang water at the sight of them. Oi was beyond them, at the edge of the circus-painted raft, looking raptly down at his own reflection, or perhaps at the reflection of the steel cable that ran overhead, spanning the river. "Is it the why?" Susanna asked Roland.
"Yar."
Eddie grinned. "You say why?
I say, why not?"
He raised one hand and waved it over his head.
"Jake! Hey, Jake! Oi!"
Jake waved back, and although the river and the raft moored at its edge were still a quarter of a mile away, their eyes were uniformly sharp, and they saw the white of the boy's teeth as he grinned. Susanna cupped her hands around her mouth.
"Oi! Oi! To me, sugar! Come see your mama!"
Uttering shrill yips that were the closest he could get to barks, Oi flew across the raft, disappeared into the barn-like structure, then emerged on their side. He came charging up the path with his ears lowered against his skull and his gold-ringed eyes bright.
"Slow down, Shug. You'll give yourself a heart attack," Susanna shouted, laughing.
Oi seemed to take this as an order to speed up. He arrived at Susanna's wheelchair in less than 2 minutes, jumped up into her lap, then jumped down again and looked at them cheerfully.
"Olin, Ed, Suze."
"Heil, Sir Thraken," Roland said, using the ancient word for bumbler he'd first heard in a book read to him by his mother, The Thraken and the Dragon. Oi lifted his leg, watered a patch of grass, then faced back the way they had come, scenting the air, eyes on the horizon.
"Why does he keep doing that, Roland?" Eddie asked.
"I don't know."
But he almost knew. Was it some old story, not The Thraken and the Dragon, but one like it? Roland thought so. For a moment he thought of green eyes, watchful in the dark, and a little shiver went through him. Not of fear, exactly, although that might have been a part of it, but of remembrance. Then it was gone.
"There will be water if God wills it," he thought, and only realized he had spoken aloud when Eddie said,
"Huh?"
"Never mind," Roland said. "Let's have a little palaver with Jake's new friend, shall we? Perhaps he has an extra popkin or two."
Eddie, tired of the chewy staple they called gunslinger burritos, brightened immediately.
"Hell yeah," he said, and looked at an imaginary watch on his tanned wrist. "Goodness me, I see it's just gobble o'clock."
"Shut up and push, honeybee," Susanna said. Eddie shut up and pushed. The old man was sitting when they entered the boathouse, standing when they emerged on the riverside. He saw the guns Roland and Eddie were wearing, the big irons with the sandalwood grips, and his eyes widened. He dropped to one knee. The day was still, and Roland actually heard his bones creak.
"Heil, gunslinger," he said,
and put an arthritis-swollen fist to the center of his forehead.
"I salute thee."
"Rise up, friend," Roland said, hoping the old man was a friend. Jake seemed to think so, and Roland had come to trust his instincts, not to mention the Billy Bumblers.
"Rise up, do."
The old man was having trouble managing it, so Eddie stepped aboard and gave him an arm.
"Thank ye, son, thank ye. Be you a gunslinger as well, or are you apprentice?"
Eddie looked at Roland. Roland gave him nothing, so Eddie looked back at the old man, shrugged, and grinned.
"Little of both, I guess. I'm Eddie Dean of New York. This is my wife, Susanna, and this is Roland Deschain of Gilead."
The riverman's eyes widened.
"Gilead that was? Do you say so?"
"Gilead that was," Roland agreed, and felt an unaccustomed sorrow rise up from his heart. Time was a face on the water, and like the great river before them, it did nothing but flow.
"Step aboard, then, and welcome. This young man and I are already fast friends, so we are."
Oi stepped onto the big raft, and the old man bent to stroke the bumbler's raised head.
"And we are, too, aren't we, fella? Does thee remember my name?"
"Bix," Oi said promptly, and then turned to the northwest again, raising his snout. His gold-ringed eyes stared raptly at the moving column of clouds that marked the path of the beam.
"Will he eat?" Bix asked them,
What I have is poor and rough, but such as there is, I'd be happy to share.
With thanks, Susanna said. She looked at the overhead cable that ran across the river on a diagonal. This is a ferry, isn't it?
Yeah, Jake said. Bix told me there are people on the other side. Not close, but not far either. He thinks they are rice farmers, but they don't come this way much.
Bix stepped off the big raft and went into the boathouse. Eddie waited until he heard the old guy rummaging around, then bent to Jake and said in a low voice, "Is he okay?"
"He's fine," Jake said. "It's the way we're going, and he's happy to have someone to take across. He says it's been years."
"I bet it has been," Eddie agreed. Bix reappeared with a wicker basket, which Roland took from him. Otherwise, the old man might have tumbled into the water. Soon they were all sitting in the wicker chairs, munching popkins filled with some sort of pink fish. It was seasoned and delicious.
"Eat all you like," Bix said. "The river's filled with shanties, and most are true-threaded. The muties I throw back. Once upon a time, we were ordered to throw the baddens up a bank so they wouldn't breed more, and for a while I did, but now..." He shrugged. "Live and let live is what I say. As someone who's lived long himself, I feel like I can say it."
"How old are you?" Jake asked.
"I turned 120 quite some time ago, but since then I've lost count, so I have. Time's short on this side of the door, Kennet."
On this side of the door. That memory of some old story tugged at Roland again, and then was gone.
"Do you follow that?"
The old man pointed to the moving band of clouds in the sky.
"We do. To the Kalas or beyond?"
"Beyond."
"To the great darkness?"
Bix looked both troubled and fascinated by the idea.
"We go our course," Roland said. "What fee would you take to cross us, Cy Ferryman?"
Bix laughed. The sound was cracked and cheerful.
"Money's no good with nothing to spend it on. You have no livestock, and it's clear as day that I have more to eat than you do. And you could always draw on me and force me to take you across."
"Never," Susanna said, looking shocked.
"I know that," Bix said, waving a hand at her. "Harriers might, and then burn my ferry for good measure once they got to the other side. But true men of the gun, never. And women, too, I suppose. You don't seem armed, missus, but with women one can never tell."
Susanna smiled thinly at this and said nothing. Bix turned to Roland.
"You come from Ludd, I wot. I'd hear of Ludd and how things go there, for it was a marvelous city, so it was, crumbling and growing strange when I knew it, but still marvelous."
The four of them exchanged a look that was all Antet, that particular telepathy they shared. It was a look that was also dark with shoom, the old mid-world term that can mean shame, but also means sorrow.
"What?" Bix asked. "What have I said? If I've asked for something you'd not give, I cry your pardon."
"Not at all," Roland said. "But Ludd..."
"Ludd is dust in the wind," Susanna said.
"Well," Eddie said, "not dust, exactly."
"Ashes," Jake said. "The kind that glow in the dark."
Bix pondered this, then nodded slowly.
"I'd hear anyway, or as much as you can tell in an hour's time. That's how long the crossing takes."
Bix bristled when they offered to help him with his preparations. It was his job, he said, and he could still do it, just not as quickly as once upon a time, when there had been farms and a few little trading posts on both sides of the river. In any case, there wasn't much to do. He fetched a stool and a large ironwood ring bolt from the boathouse, mounted the stool to attach the ring bolt to the top of the post, then hooked the ring bolt to the cable. He took the stool back inside and returned with a large metal crank shaped like a block Z. This he laid with some ceremony by a wooden housing on the far end of the raft.
"Don't none of you kick that overboard or I'll never get home," he said.
Roland squatted on his hunkers to study it. He beckoned to Eddie and Jake, who joined him. He pointed to the words embossed on the long stroke of the Z.
"Does it say what I think it does?"
Yep, Eddie said. North Central Positronics, our old pals.
When did you get that, Bix? Susanna asked.
90 years ago or more, if I were to guess. There's an underground place over there.
He pointed vaguely in the direction of the Green Palace.
It goes for miles, and it's full of things that belong to the old people, perfectly preserved. Strange music still plays from overhead, music such as you've never heard. It scrambles your thinking, like. And you don't dare stay there long, or you break out in sores and puke and start to lose your teeth. I went once, never again. I thought for a while I was going to die.
Did you lose your hair as well as your chompers? Eddie asked. Bix looked surprised, then nodded.
Yar, some, but it grew back. That crank, it's still, you know.
Eddie pondered this for a moment. Of course it was still. It was an inanimate object. Then he realized that the old man was saying steel.
Are you ready?
Bix asked them. His eyes were nearly as bright as Oi's.
Shall I cast off?
Eddie snapped off a crisp salute.
Aye, aye, Captain. We're away to the treasure isles. Arr, so we be. Come and help me with these ropes, Roland of Gilead. Will you do?
Roland did, and gladly. The raft moved slowly along the diagonal cable, pulled by the river's slow current. Fish jumped all around them as Roland's quartet took turns telling the old man about the city of Lud and what had befallen them there. For a while, Oi watched the fish with interest, his paws planted on the upstream edge of the raft. Then he once more sat and faced back the way they had come, snout raised. Bix grunted when they told him how they'd left the doomed city.
Blame the mono, you say. I remember. Crack train. There was another one, too, although I can't remember the name.
Patricia, Susanna said.
Aye, that was it. Beautiful glass sides she had, and you say the city's all gone?
All gone, Jake agreed. Bix lowered his head.
Sad.
It is, Susanna said, taking his hand and giving it a brief, light squeeze. Midworld's a sad place, although it can be very beautiful. They had reached the middle of the river now, and a light breeze, surprisingly warm, ruffled their hair. They had all laid aside their heavy outer clothes and sat at ease in the wicker passenger chairs, which rolled this way and that, presumably for the views this provided. A large fish, probably one of the kind that had fed their bellies at Gobble O'Clock, jumped onto the raft and lay there, flopping at Oi's feet. Although he was usually death on any small creature that crossed his path, the bumbler appeared not to even notice it. Roland kicked it back into the water with one of his scuffed boots.
"Your Thrakken knows it's coming," Bix remarked.
He looked at Roland.
"You'll want to take heed, eh?"
For a moment, Roland could say nothing. A clear memory rose from the back of his mind to the front, one of a dozen hand-colored woodcut illustrations in an old and well-loved book. Six bumblers sitting on a fallen tree in the forest beneath a crescent moon, all with their snouts raised. That volume, Magic Tales of the Eld, he had loved above all others when he had been but a small one, listening to his mother as she read him to sleep in his high tower bedroom, while an autumn gale sang its lonely song outside, calling down winter. The Wind Through the Keyhole was the name of the story that went with the picture, and it had been both terrible and wonderful.
All my gods on the hill, Roland said, and thumped the heel of his reduced right hand to his brow. I should have known right away, if only from how warm it's gotten the last few days. You mean you didn't? Bix asked. And you from in-world?
He made a tisking sound. Roland? Susanna asked. What is it? Roland ignored her. He looked from Bix to Oi and then back to Bix.
The Stark Blast's coming.
Bix nodded.
Aye. Thrakken says so, and about the Stark Blast, the Thrakken are never wrong. Other than speaking a little, it's their bright.
Bright what? Eddie asked. He means their talent, Roland said. Bix, Do you know of a place on the other side where we can hide up and wait for it to pass?
Happens I do.
The old man pointed to the wooded hills sloping gently down to the far side of the Hwai, where another dock and another boathouse, this one unpainted and far less grand, waited for them.
You'll find your way forward on the other side, a little lane that used to be a road. It follows the path of the beam.
Sure it does, Jake said. All things serve the beam.
As you say, young man, as you say. Which do we ken, wheels or miles?
Both, Eddie said, but for most of us, miles are better.
All right, then. Follow the old collar road, 5 miles, maybe 6, and you'll come to a deserted village. Most of the buildings are wood and no use to ye, but the town meeting hall is good stone. You'll be fine there. I've been inside, and there's a lovely big fireplace. You'll want to check the chimney, of course, as you'll want a good draw up its throat for the day or two you'll have to sit it out. As for wood, you can use what's left of the houses.
What is this stark blast? Susanna asked. Is it a storm?
Yes, Roland said. I haven't seen one in many, many years. It's a lucky thing we had Oi with us. Even then I wouldn't have known, if not for Bix.
He squeezed the old man's shoulder.
Thank'ee, Si. We all say thank'ee.
The boathouse, on the southeastern side of the river, was on the verge of collapse, like so many things in Midworld. Bats roosted heads down from the rafters, and fat spiders scuttered up the walls. They were all glad to be out of it and back under the open sky. Bix tied up and joined them. They each embraced him, being careful not to hug tight and hurt his old bones. When they'd all taken their turn, the old man wiped his eyes, then bent and stroked Oi's head.
Keep 'em well, do, Sir Thrakken.
Oi, the bumbler replied. Then,
Bix.
The old man straightened, and again they heard his bones crackle. He put his hands to the small of his back and winced.
Will you be able to get back across okay? Eddie asked.
Oh, aye, Bix said. If it was spring, I might not, though I ain't so placid when the snow melts and the rains come, but now, piece of piss. The storm's still some way off. I crank for a bit against the current, then click the bolt tight so I can rest and not slip backwards, and I crank some more. It might take 4 hours instead of one, but I'll get there. I always have, anyway. I only wish I had some more food to give ye.
We'll be fine, Roland said.
Good, then. Good.
The old man seemed reluctant to leave. He looked from face to face, seriously, then grinned, exposing toothless gums.
We're well met along the path, are we not?
So we are, Roland agreed.
And if you come back this way, stop and visit a while with old Bix. Tell him of your adventures.
We will, Susanna said, although she knew they would never be this way again. It was a thing they all knew.
And mind the stark blast. It's nothing to fool with. But you might have a day yet, or even two. He's not turning circles yet, are ye, Oi?
Oi, the bumbler agreed.
Bix fetched a sigh.
Now you go your way, he said, and I go mine. We'll both be laid up under cover soon enough.
Roland and his tet started up the path.
One other thing, Bix called after them, and they turned back. If you see that cussed Andy, tell him I don't want no songs and I don't want my God's damned horoscope read.
Who's Andy? Jake called back.
Ah, never mind. You probably won't see him anyway.
That was the old man's last word on it, and none of them remembered it, although they did meet Andy in the farming community of Colibrin Sturgis, but that was later, after the storm had passed. It was only 5 miles to the deserted village, and they arrived less than an hour after they left the ferry. It took Roland less time than that to tell them about the Stark Blast. They used to come down on the great woods north of New Canaan once or twice a year, although we never had one in Gilead. They always rose away into the air before they got so far. But I remember once seeing carts loaded with frozen bodies drawn down Gilead Road, farmers and their families, I suppose. Where their Thrakken had been, their billy bumblers, I don't know, Perhaps they took sick and died. In any case, with no bumblers to warn them, those folks were unprepared. The Stark blast comes suddenly, you can. One moment you're warm as toast, because the weather always warms up before, and then it falls on you, like wolves on a ruddle of lambs. The only warning is the sound the trees make as the cold of the Stark blast rolls over them. A kind of thudding sound, like grenades covered with dirt. The sound living wood makes when it contracts all at once, I suppose. And by the time they heard that, it would have been too late for those in the fields. Cold, Eddie mused. How cold? The temperature can fall to as much as 40 limbets below freezing in less than an hour, Roland said grimly. Ponds freeze in an instant with a sound like bullets breaking window panes. Birds turn to ice statues in the sky and fall like rocks. Grass turns to glass. You're exaggerating, Susanna said. You must be. Not at all. But the cold's only part of it. The wind comes, too. Gale force, snapping the frozen trees off like straws. Such storms might roll for 300 wheels before lifting off into the sky as suddenly as they came. How do the bumblers know? Jake asked. Roland only shook his head. The how and why of things had never interested him much. They came to a broken piece of signboard lying on the path. Eddie picked it up and read the faded remains of a single word. It sums up Midworld perfectly, he said. Mysterious yet strangely hilarious. He turned toward them with the piece of wood held at chest level. What it said in large, uneven letters was, Gook. A gook is a deep well, Roland said. Common law says any traveler may drink from it without let or penalty. Welcome to Gook, Eddie said, tossing the signboard into the bushes at the side of the road. I like it. In fact, I want a bumper sticker that says, I waited out the Stark blast in Gook. Susanna laughed. Jake didn't. He only pointed at Oi, who had begun turning in tight, rapid circles, as if chasing his own tail. We might want to hurry a little, the boy said. The woods drew back, and the path widened to what had once been a village high street. The village itself was a sad cluster of abandonment that ran on both sides for about a quarter of a mile. Some of the buildings had been houses, some stores, but now it was impossible to tell which had been which. They were nothing but slumped shells staring out of dark, empty sockets that might once have held glass. The only exception stood at the southern end of the town. Here, the overgrown high street split around a squat, blockhouse-like building constructed of gray fieldstone. It stood hip-deep in overgrown shrubbery, and was partly concealed by young fir trees that must have grown up since Gook had been abandoned. The roots had already begun to work their way into the meeting hall's foundations. In the course of time, they would bring it down, and time was one thing Midworld had in abundance. He was right about the wood, Eddie said. He picked up a weathered plank and laid it across the arms of Susanna's wheelchair like a makeshift table. We'll have plenty. He cast an eye at Jake's furry pal, who was once more turning in brisk circles. If we have time to pick it up, that is. We'll start gathering as soon as we make sure we've got yonder stone building to ourselves, Roland said. Let's make this quick. The Gook meeting hall was chilly, and birds, what the New Yorkers thought of as swallows and Roland called bin rusties, had gotten into the second floor, but otherwise they did indeed have the place to themselves. Once he was under a roof, Oi seemed freed of his compulsion to either face northwest or turn in circles, and he immediately reverted to his essential curious nature, bounding up the rickety stairs toward the soft flutterings and cooings above. He began his shrill yapping, and soon the members of the Tet saw the bin rusties streaking away toward less populated areas of Midworld. Although, if Roland was right, Jake thought, the ones heading in the direction of the River Wye would all too soon be turned into birdsicles. The first floor consisted of a single large room, Tables and benches had been stacked against the walls. Roland, Eddie, and Jake carried these to the glassless windows, which were mercifully small and covered the openings. The ones on the northwest side they covered from the outside, so the wind from that direction would press them tighter rather than blow them over. While they did this, Susanna rolled her wheelchair into the mouth of the fireplace, a thing she was able to accomplish without even ducking her head. She peered up, grasped a rusty hanging ring, and pulled it. There was a hellish screech sound, a pause, and then a great black cloud of soot descended on her in a flump. Her reaction was immediate, colorful, and all Detta Walker. "Oh, kiss my ass and go to heaven," she screamed. "You cock-knocking motherfucker, just look at this shittin' mess." She rolled back out, coughing and waving her hands in front of her face. The wheels of her chair left tracks in the soot. A huge pile of the stuff lay in her lap. She slapped it away in a series of hard strokes that were more like punches. "Filthy fucking chimbley! Dirty old cunt tunnel! You badass son of a bitch!" She turned and saw Jake staring at her, open-mouthed and wide-eyed. Beyond him on the stairs, Oi was doing the same thing. "Sorry, honey," Susanna said. "I got a little carried away. Mostly I'm mad at myself. I grew up with stoves and fireplaces and should have known better." In a tone of deepest respect, Jake said, "You know better swears than my father. I didn't think anyone knew better swears than my father." Eddie went to Susanna and started wiping at her face and neck. She brushed his hands away. "You're just spreading it around. Let's go see if we can find that gook or whatever it is. Maybe the still water."
"There will be if God wills it," Roland said.
She swiveled to regard him with narrowed eyes. "You being smart, Roland? You don't want to be smart while I'm sitting here like Mrs. Tar, baby."
"No, Si, never think it," Roland said, but there was the tiniest twitch at the left corner of his mouth.
"Eddie, see if you can find gook water so Susanna can clean herself. Jake and I will begin gathering wood. We'll need you to help us as soon as you can. I hope our friend Bix has made it to his side of the river, because I think time is shorter than he guessed." The town well was on the other side of the meeting hall, in what Eddie thought might once have been the town common. The rope hanging from the crank-operated drum beneath the well's rotting cap was long gone, but that was no problem. They had a coil of good rope in their gunnel. "The problem," Eddie said, "is what we're going to tie to the end of the rope. I suppose one of Roland's old saddlebags might..." "What's that, honeybee?" Susanna was pointing at a patch of high grass and brambles to the left side of the well. "I don't see..." But then he did, a gleam of rusty metal. Taking care to be scratched by the thorns as little as possible, Eddie reached into the tangle and, with a grunt of effort, pulled out a rusty bucket with a coil of dead ivy inside. There was even a handle. "Let me see that," Susanna said. He dumped out the ivy and handed it over. She tested the handle, and it broke immediately, not with a snap, but with a soft, punky sigh. Susanna looked at him apologetically and shrugged. "It's okay," Eddie said. "Better to know now than when it's down in the well." He tossed the handle aside, cut off a chunk of their rope, untwisted the outer strands to thin it, and threaded what was left through the holes that had held the old handle. "Not bad," Susanna said. "You mighty handy for a white boy." She peered over the lip of the well. "I can see the water, not even 10 feet down. Ooh, it looks cold." "Chimney sweeps can't be choosers," Eddie said. The bucket splashed down, tilted, and began to fill. When it sank below the surface of the water, Eddie hauled it back up. It had sprung several leaks at spots where the rust had eaten through, but they were small ones. He took off his shirt, dipped it in the water, and began to wash her face. "Oh, my goodness," he said. "I see a girl." She took the balled-up shirt, rinsed it, wrung it out, and began to do her arms. "At least I got the dang flue open. You can draw some more water once I get the worst of this mess cleaned off me, and when we get a fire going, I can wash and warm..." Far to the northwest, they heard a low, thudding crump. There was a pause, then a second one. It was followed by several more, then a perfect fusillade. Coming in their direction like marching feet, their startled eyes met. Eddie, bare to the waist, went to the back of a wheelchair. "I think we better speed this up." In the distance, but definitely moving closer, came sounds that could have been armies at war. "I think you're right," Susanna said. When they got back, they saw Roland and Jake running toward the meeting hall with armloads of decaying lumber and splintered chunks of wood. Still well across the river, but definitely closer, came those low, crumping explosions as trees in the path of the Stark Blast yanked themselves inward toward their tender cores. Oi was in the middle of the overgrown high street, turning and turning. Susanna tipped herself out of her wheelchair, landed neatly on her hands, and began crawling toward the meeting house. "What the hell are you doing?" Eddie asked. "You can carry more wood in the chair. Pile it high. I'll get Roland to give me his flint and steel and get a fire going. But mind me, Eddie. Let me do what I can. And put your shirt back on. I know it's wet, but it'll keep you from getting scratched up." He did so, then turned the chair, tilted it on its big back wheels, and pushed it toward the nearest likely source of fuel. As he passed Roland, he gave the gunslinger Susanna's message. Roland nodded and kept running, peering over his armload of wood. The three of them went back and forth without speaking, gathering wood against the cold on this weirdly warm afternoon. The path of the beam in the sky was temporarily gone, because all the clouds were in motion, rolling away to the southeast. Susanna had gotten a fire going, and it roared beastly up the chimney. The big downstairs room had a huge jumble of wood in the center, some with rusty nails poking out. So far, none of them had been cut or punctured, but Eddie thought it was just a matter of time. He tried to remember when he'd last had a tetanus shot, and couldn't. As for Roland, he thought, his blood would probably kill any germ the second it dared show its head inside that leather bag he calls skin. "What are you smiling about?" Jake asked. The words came out in little out-of-breath gasps. The arms of his shirt were filthy and covered with splinters. There was a long smudge of dirt on his forehead. "Nothing much, little hero. Watch out for rusty nails. One more load each and we'd better call it good. It's close."
"Okay."
The thuds were on their side of the river now, and the air, although still warm, had taken on a queer, thick quality. Eddie loaded up Susanna's wheelchair a final time and trundled it back toward the meeting house. Jake and Roland were ahead of him. He could feel heat baking out of the open door. "It better get cold," he thought, "or we're going to fucking roast in there." Then, as he waited for the two ahead of him to turn sideways so they could get their loads of lumber inside, a thin and pervasive screaming joined the pops and thuds of contracting wood. It made the hair bristle on the nape of Eddie's neck. The wind coming toward them sounded alive and in agony. The air began to move again. First it was warm, then cool enough to dry the sweat on his face, then cold. This happened in a matter of seconds. The creepy screech of the wind was joined by a fluttering sound that made Eddie think of the plastic pennants you sometimes saw strung around used car lots. It ramped up to a whirr, and leaves began to blow off the trees, first in bundles and then in sheets. The branches thrashed against clouds that were lensing darker, even as he looked at them, mouth agape. "Oh, shit," he said, and ran the wheelchair straight at the door. For the first time in 10 trips, it stuck. The planks he'd stacked across the chair's arms were too wide. With any other load, the ends would have snapped off with the same soft, almost apologetic sound the bucket handle had made, but not this time. Oh, no, not now that the storm was almost here. Was nothing in Midworld ever easy? He reached over the back of the chair to shove the longest boards aside, and that's when Jake shouted, "Oi! Oi's still out there! Oi, to me!
Oi took no notice. He had stopped his turning. Now he only sat with his snout raised toward the coming storm, his gold-ringed eyes fixed and dreamy. Jake didn't think, and he didn't look for nails that were protruding from Eddie's last load of lumber. He simply scrambled up the splintery pile and jumped. He struck Eddie, sending him staggering back. Eddie tried to keep his balance, but tripped on his own feet and fell on his butt. Jake went to one knee, then scrambled up, eyes wide, long hair blowing back from his head, in a tangle of licks and ringlets.
Jake, no!
Eddie grabbed for him and got nothing but the cuff of the kid's shirt. It had been thinned by many washings in many streams and tore away. Roland was in the doorway. He batted the two long boards to the right and left, as heedless of the protruding nails as Jake had been. The gunslinger yanked the wheelchair through the doorway and grunted,
"Get in here."
"Jake."
"Jake will either be all right or he won't." Roland seized Eddie by the arm and hauled him to his feet. Their old blue jeans were making machine gun noises around their legs as the wind whipped them.
"He's on his own. Get in here."
"No, fuck you."
Roland didn't argue, simply yanked Eddie through the door. Eddie went sprawling. Susanna knelt in front of the fire, staring at him. Her face was streaming with sweat, and the front of her deerskin shirt was soaked. Roland stood in the doorway, face grim, watching Jake run to his friend. Jake felt the temperature of the air around him plummet. A branch broke off with a dry snap, and he ducked as it whistled over his head. Oi never stirred until Jake snatched him up. Then the bumbler looked around wildly, baring his teeth.
"Bite if you have to," Jake said, "but I won't put you down."
Oi didn't bite, and Jake might not have felt it if he had. His face was numb. He turned back toward the meeting house, and the wind became a huge, cold hand planted in the middle of his back. He began running again, aware that now he was doing so in absurd leaps, like an astronaut running on the surface of the moon in a science fiction movie. One leap, two, three. But on the third one, he didn't come down. He was blown straight forward with Oi cradled in his arms. There was a guttural, grumphing explosion as one of the old houses gave in to the wind and went flying southeast in a hail of shrapnel. He saw a flight of stairs, the crude plank banister still attached, spinning up toward the racing clouds. "We'll be next," he thought, and then a hand, minus two fingers, but still strong, gripped him above the elbow. Roland turned him toward the door. For a moment the issue was in doubt as the wind bullied them away from safety. Then Roland lunged forward into the doorway, with his remaining fingers sinking deep into Jake's flesh. The pressure of the wind abruptly left them, and they both landed on their backs.
"Thank God," Susanna cried.
"Thank him later."
Roland was shouting to be heard over the pervasive bellow of the gale.
"Push. All of you push on this damn door. Susanna, you at the bottom. All your strength. You bar it, Jake. Do you understand me? Drop the bar into the clamps. Don't hesitate."
"Don't worry about me," Jake snapped.
Something had gashed him at one temple, and a thin ribbon of blood ran down the side of his face, but his eyes were clear and sure.
"Now, push. Push for your lives."
The door swung slowly shut. They could not have held it long, mere seconds, but they didn't have to. Jake dropped the thick wooden bar, and when they moved cautiously back, the rusty clamps held. They looked at each other, gasping for breath, then down at Oi, who gave a single cheerful yap and went to toast himself by the fire. The spell that the oncoming storm had cast on him seemed to be broken. Away from the hearth, the big room was already growing cold.
"You should have let me grab the kid, Roland," Eddie said. "He could have been killed out there."
Oi was Jake's responsibility. He should have gotten him inside sooner, tied him to something if he had to.
"Or don't you think so, Jake?"
"Yeah, I do."
Jake sat down beside Oi, stroking the bumbler's thick fur with one hand and rubbing blood from his face with the other.
"Roland," Susanna said, "he's just a boy." No more, Roland said. Cry your pardon, but no more. For the first 2 hours of the Stark Blast, they were in some doubt if even the stone meeting house would hold. The wind screamed and trees snapped. One slammed down on the roof and smashed it. Cold air jetted through the boards above them. Susanna and Eddie put their arms around each other. Jake shielded Oi, now lying placidly on his back with his stubby legs splayed to all points of the compass, and looked up at the swirling cloud of bird shit that had sifted through the cracks in the ceiling. Roland went on, calmly laying out their little supper. "What do you think, Roland?" Eddie asked. "I think if this building stands one more hour, we'll be fine. The cold will intensify, but the wind will drop a little when dark comes. It will drop still more come tomorrow light, and by the day after tomorrow, the air will be still and much warmer. Not like it was before the coming of the storm, but that warmth was unnatural, and we all knew it." He regarded them with a half-smile. It looked strange on his face, which was usually so still and grave. "In the meantime, we have a good fire. Not enough to heat the whole room, but fine enough if we stay close to it. And a little time to rest. We've been through much, have we not?" "Yeah," Jake said. "Too much. And more ahead, I have no doubt. Danger, hard work, sorrow. Death, mayhap. So now we sit by the fire, as in the old days, and take what comfort we can." He surveyed them, still with that little smile. The firelight cast him in strange profile, making him young on one side of his face and ancient on the other. "We are quartet. We are one from many. Be grateful for warmth, shelter, and companionship against the storm. Others may not be so lucky." "We'll hope they are," Susanna said. She was thinking of Bix. "Come," Roland said. "Eat." They came and settled themselves around their din, and ate what he had set out for them. Susanna slept for an hour or two early that night, but her dreams of nasty, maggoty foods she was somehow compelled to eat woke her. Outside, the wind continued to howl, although its sound was not quite so steady now. Sometimes it seemed to drop away entirely, then rose again, uttering long, icy shrieks as it ran under the eaves in cold currents and made the stone building tremble in its old bones. The door thudded rhythmically against the bar holding it shut, but like the ceiling above them, both the bar and the rusty clamp seemed to be holding. She wondered what would have become of them if the wooden bar had been as punky and rotted as the handle of the bucket they'd found near the gook. Roland was awake and sitting by the fire. Jake was with him. Between them, Oi was asleep with one paw over his snout. Susanna joined them. The fire had burned down a little, but this close, it threw a comforting heat on her face and arms. She took a board, thought about snapping it in two, decided it might wake Eddie, and tossed it onto the fire as it was. Sparks gushed up the chimney, swirling as the draft caught them. She could have spared the consideration, because while the sparks were still swirling, a hand caressed the back of her neck just below the hairline. She didn't have to look. She would have known that touch anywhere. Without turning, she took the hand, brought it to her mouth, and kissed the cup of the palm. The white palm. Even after all this time together and all the lovemaking, she could sometimes hardly believe that. Yet there it was. "At least I won't have to bring him home to meet my parents," she thought. "Can't sleep, sugar?" "A little, not much. I had funny dreams." "The wind brings them," Roland said. "Anyone in Gilead would tell you the same. But I love the sound of the wind. I always have. It soothes my heart and makes me think of old times." He looked away, as if embarrassed to have said so much. "None of us can sleep," Jake said, "so tell us a story." Roland looked into the fire for a while, then at Jake. The gunslinger was once more smiling, but his eyes were distant. A knot popped in the fireplace. Outside the stone walls, the wind screamed as if furious at its inability to get in. Eddie put an arm around Susanna's waist and she laid her head on his shoulder. "What story would you hear, Jake, son of Elmer?"
"Any."
He paused. "About the old days." Rowan looked at Eddie and Susanna. "And you? Would you hear?"
"Yes, please," Susanna said. Eddie nodded.
"Yeah, if you want to, that is."
Rowan considered. "Mayhap I'll tell you too, since it's long until dawn, and we can sleep tomorrow away if we like."
These tales nest inside each other, yet the wind blows through both, which is a good thing. There's nothing like stories on a windy night when folks have found a warm place in a cold world. He took a broken piece of wood paneling, poked the glowing embers with it, then fed it to the flames. "One I know is a true story, for I lived it along with my old comrade, Jamie DeCurry. The other, The Wind Through the Keyhole, is one my mother read to me when I was still small. Old stories can be useful, you know, and I should have thought of this one as soon as I saw Oi scenting the air as he did, but that was long ago." He sighed. "Gone days." In the dark, beyond the firelight, the wind rose to a howl. Roland waited for it to die a little, then began. Eddie, Susanna, and Jake listened, rapt, all through that long and contentious night. Lud, the Tick-Tock Man, Blaine the Mono, the Green Palace, all were forgotten. Even the Dark Tower itself was forgotten for a bit. There was only Roland's voice, rising and falling. Rising and falling like the wind. Not long after the death of my mother, which, as you know, came by my own hand. The Skin Man, Part 1. Not long after the death of my mother, which, as you know, came by my own hand, my father, Stephen, son of Henry the Tall, summoned me to his study in the north wing of the palace. It was a small, cold room. I remember the wind whining around the slit windows. I remember the high, frowning shelves of books. Worth a fortune they were, but never read, not by him, anyway. And I remember the black collar of mourning he wore. It was the same as my own. Every man in Gilead wore the same collar, or a band around his shirt sleeve. The women wore black nets on their hair. This would go on until Gabrielle Deschain was 6 months in her tomb. I saluted him, fist to forehead. He didn't look up from the papers on his desk, but I knew he saw it. My father saw everything, and very well. I waited. He signed his name several times while the wind whistled and the rooks cawed in the courtyard. The fireplace was a dead socket. He rarely called for it to be lit, even on the coldest days. At last he looked up. "How is court, Roland? How goes it with your teacher that was? You must know, because I've been given to understand that you spend most of your time in his hut, feeding him and such." "He has days when he knows me," I said. "Many days he doesn't. He still sees a little from one eye. The other..." I didn't need to finish. The other was gone. My hawk, David, had taken it from him in my test of manhood. Court, in turn, had taken David's life, but that was to be his last kill. "I know what happened to his other peep. Do you truly feed him?"
"Aye, father, I do."
"Do you clean him when he messes?" I stood there before his desk like a chastened schoolboy called before the master, and that is how I felt. Only how many chastened schoolboys have killed their own mothers? "Answer me, Roland. I am your din as well as your father, and I'd have you answer."
"Sometimes."
Which was not really a lie. Sometimes I changed his dirty clouts 3 and 4 times a day. Sometimes, on the good days, only once or not at all. He could get to the Jakes if I helped him, and if he remembered, he had to go. "Does he not have the white ammies who come in?"
"I sent them away," I said.
He looked at me with real curiosity. I searched for contempt in his face. Part of me wanted to see it, but there was none that I could tell. Did I raise you to the guns so you could become an Ammie and nurse a broken old man? I felt my anger flash at that. Cord had raised a moit of boys to the tradition of the Eld in the way of the